last Sunday to this Sunday, we took a giant leap in Mark's gospel. Last week, we were at the beginning of the gospel and the beginning of Jesus' ministry. This week, we're at the point from which Jesus will turn toward Jerusalem and the cross. Last week, I talked about Jesus being both fully human and fully divine. I described several early Christian heresies and noted that early Christian theologians may have found it easier to accept his full divinity and harder to accept his full humanity. Read the Gospels, though, and you have to wonder whether Jesus' earliest followers had the opposite concern. That is, early Christ followers may have found it easier to accept Jesus' full humanity and harder to accept his full divinity. That would make sense. After all, many of those early Christ followers would have known Jesus in the flesh, or at least known someone who knew Jesus in the flesh. They would also have known of others or known of others who claimed the power of miraculous healing or the power to prophesy. But those early Christ followers knew that Jesus was different. They even came to believe that Jesus was God. And the Gospels are written to give us that evidence. Case in point, today's reading, the story of the Transfiguration. For this Epiphany, Jesus goes up to the mountain, taking with him Peter and James and John. You have to feel for Jesus if his most reliable crew members are Peter and James and John. This is the same trio that will fail to meet Jesus' request to stay awake with him during the last night in Gethsemane. Apparently, they're reliable enough, though. They witness Jesus' transfiguration and the appearance of Moses and Elijah. Moses and Elijah are two of the most important figures in the Jewish tradition. Here they likely represent the law and the prophets. That mountaintop experience literally brings Jesus up to their level, but God doesn't leave it at that. In chapter 1 of Mark, immediately after John baptized Jesus, a voice came from heaven saying, "You are my son, the beloved. With you I am well pleased." It's inferred there that only Jesus heard that voice. Here in chapter 9, those words are nearly repeated. "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." But now, there are three witnesses to those words. Those witnesses are important. As the story continues, we learn that Jesus doesn't intend to limit his good news to his fellow Jews or to his time on earth. God's new covenant is with the whole world. It's a message that those first Jewish Christ followers must help take to the world. The kingdom of God has drawn near to all creation. The spark of the divine will be denied to no one. In Episcopal Church news, the big story over the last week or so has to do with Washington National Cathedral and last Sunday's preacher, Max Lucado. Lucado is a hugely successful author. Wikipedia says that he's written nearly 100 books with some 130 million copies in print. He's also a Christian pastor of the conservative evangelical variety. In a 2004 sermon, he expressed his views about LGBTQ people using the overtired and yet ever popular argument that same-sex marriage leads to incest and legalized bestiality. Regarding same-sex marriage, he posed a rhetorical question then about what's next, and then answered it himself. A marriage between a daddy and a daughter, or a woman and a giraffe? Don't underestimate the evil bent of the human heart. He also expressed support for the thoroughly debunked concept of gay conversion therapy. When news of Lucado's preaching invitation broke earlier in the week, the outcry from LGBTQ Episcopalians and their supporters was swift and strong. In response to that, Cathedral Dean Randy Hollerith lifted up the importance of engaging with people with whom we disagree. Many replied that conversation across difference ought not to include offering up the most prestigious pulpit in the Episcopal Church to someone with such harmful views. He did not rescind that invitation. He did go on to invite retired Bishop Gene Robinson to preside at the service. You may remember that Bishop Gene was the first out gay person ordained bishop in the Anglican Communion, an event that resulted in huge fractures in the Episcopal Church and around the Anglican Communion. Last Sunday, after what I understand was an innocuous sermon from Lucado, I didn't listen to it, Bishop Gene offered some words at the offertory, which I did watch. He said that when it comes to LGBTQ people in the church, we've won. We know how this is going to end. With all due respect to Bishop Gene, many of us are not so sure. Yes, we have come a long way, and yet, even in the Episcopal Church here in Connecticut, there are still many congregations that would never call an LGBTQ priest. In Christianity writ large, current conditions are even less encouraging. Christianity's relationship with people who are LGBTQ has been much on my mind in recent months. I could point to the rise of white supremacy and Christian nationalism. We tend to notice and acknowledge that they're very virulently anti-black and anti-Semitic and anti-immigrant, but we sometimes forget that they are also virulently anti-gay. Risk of violence to LGBTQ people was included in a national security warning that came out just a couple of weeks ago. I could also mention the shift in the makeup of the Supreme Court, whose majority members espouse a Christianity that would nullify my marriage to Jackie. The news from the National Cathedral came a day or two after I was disturbed by another article. That one was about a black pastor in Texas, Dwight McKissick, who had just removed the church where he serves as founding pastor from the Texas Southern Baptist Convention. He's threatening to remove the church from the entire Southern Baptist Convention, the national body. He took that action because a Texas SBC pastor, white Texas SBC pastor, called our vice president Jezebel Harris. Jezebel has long been used as a pejorative for black women. Good, I thought. But I read the whole article, and further along I read that McKissick himself in 2015 had quite rudely compared a noted black United Church of Christ pastor to Jezebel because she's married to a woman. When asked about it, he said he didn't actually call her Jezebel, he likened her to Jezebel, and anyway, that's different. All this is nothing new. Last August, I happened to hear the faith stories of two fairly prominent lesbians, both in their late 30s, both of whom grew up Roman Catholic. I like to think that folks 20 years younger than me had an easier time coming out. Of course, I should know better. One of those two women is the comic Cameron Esposito. Esposito grew up in a devout Roman Catholic family. She attended Catholic schools right through her undergraduate degree at Boston College. At one point, she wanted to be a priest, knowing that wasn't going to happen. Her memoir published last year is titled Save Yourself. That title, Save Yourself, probably tells you everything you need to know about her current relationship with Christianity. The other one of the two is soccer star Abby Wambach. I heard her interviewed on Nadia Bolt Weber's podcast, The Confessional. Nadia Bolt Weber is a fairly well-known Lutheran pastor and author. In her podcast, she speaks with people who talk about something they did that they regret, And at the end, she offers them a customized absolution. It's really pretty interesting, and the absolutions are always lovely. Wambach went on to confess her behavior during the breakup of her first marriage, the drinking problem that developed after a soccer injury, and her DUI arrest, after which she spent the night in jail. Now, I'm going to play part of that interview, and I'm going to apologize in advance. Some of the language is a little bit crude, so we're going to go for it anyway.
So, what ended up happening after you spent that night in jail?
What ended up happening is the world found out, right? The world found out that Abby Wambach, captain of the women's national team, got drunk and drove. Not many people know, like, the real depth of what was going on in my life, and that's kind of what I wanted to talk about with you.
Okay, for sure. Let's talk about that. Also, I'm just really curious to hear you talk about that time between breaking your leg and getting the DUI. Like, what was going on for you during that time?
For me, those 8 years, it was just kind of this recipe for disaster, almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, because I think as my life kind of took a turn towards the rock bottom that I was headed towards, you know, these feelings of deep shame about who I was started to surface that were kind of implanted in me as a really young gay kid sitting in the pew in the Catholic church.
Oh, shit. Okay, draw the line for me between those two things.
Yeah, I grew up in an Irish Catholic family, youngest of seven. And around 15 or 16 years old, I knew that I was a little different, and it wasn't because of sports. I knew that I was going to probably live a gay life. And sitting in those pews for pretty much the whole of my existence, knowing what this Catholic Church thought of, felt about gay people, it was the most traumatic, I think, and terrifying times of my life. And that it really set me up in many ways to kind of really run for the hills from that church for decades, quite honestly.
I actually, you know what? I remember you said something directly to me that I don't think I'll ever forget. When I asked you about your religious upbringing, the words you said were, I knew fairly young that I had to choose between my religion and myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I was basically choosing between God and my mom.
Oh, wow.
And myself.
Wow.
I think that my first marriage was really on the rocks. And the thing that was driving me so crazy is the failure of my marriage in some ways meant to me on a deep level that maybe my mom was right, that maybe I am an abomination.
Oh, shit.
That maybe this was all a part of God's plan.
So it wasn't just the...
Perhaps it should have been clear that Wambach's first marriage was to a woman. I expected that one of the great things about serving at St. Thomas's would be its proximity to a seminary. What I didn't expect was the number of LGBTQ seminarians who would come to speak with me about the internal struggle they were still having with being queer and Christian. Most are in their 20s, some are in their 30s. Some come from Roman Catholic backgrounds, some from fundamentalist backgrounds, some are even lifelong Episcopalians. Some were so far along as to be postulants for ordination as priests, and yet they were still struggling. Most had broken relationships with their families of origin, most worried over their relationship with God. Most said something like this, "It's just so hard. Why do I have to be gay?" A lot of tears had been shed in my office over this. They cry when we're together, and I cry after they leave. on Wednesday, both Dean Hollerith and Diocese of Washington Bishop Marianne Edgar Buddy issued apologies for what they called the mistake of inviting Lucado to preach. They're holding a listening session tonight for LGBTQ folks and their supporters. I wish I felt more appreciative of that, but instead I remain baffled as to how it could be that they seem not to have been listening all along. In her apology, Bishop Marianne included comments from 12 of the people who wrote to her about this. I was going to read a couple of them, but this sermon is too long already, so I'll refer you to them to read on your own. I'm also going to refer you to a blog post by one of my former seminary professors, who's a theologian and a gay man who's now serving in parish ministry. The title of that post is Bad Theology Kills. I'll put the links in the chat after the service. Now, after the furor over his preaching gig, Lucado sent a letter to the Washington National Cathedral. He did not walk back his position on same-sex marriage or conversion therapy, but he did apologize for his words in 2004, saying this: I was disrespectful, I was hurtful, I wounded people in ways that were devastating, I should have done better. And he did say of LGBTQ people, they are beloved children of God because they are made in the image and likeness of God. I guess he's tossed us a bone, if a very dried up bone, but maybe God will put some flesh on it and breathe some life into it. By that I mean, maybe it will be enough to provide a path to love, for a queer kid to love himself, or for a family to love them. Some years ago, I wrote a collect, a prayer, that I intended for use at an LGBTQ pride prayer service. It really applies to everyone. Remember, the image of God in Latin is Imago Dei. There's another concept in Roman Catholicism that in Latin terms every Roman Catholic priest an alter Christus. That is, every priest is another Christ, an alter Christus. I think that's actually a useful concept if it is applied to all members of the body of Christ, all who are baptized into the priesthood of all believers, all who serve God by serving others. The prayer that I wrote includes this line: by your birth, you are Imago Dei. By your baptism, you are alter Christus. It remains distressing to think that so much of the energy for anti-LGBTQ activism comes from my fellow Christians. It doesn't have to be that way. It's not the only way. It's not even the Christian way. So let's return where we started, to that mountaintop with Jesus and Moses and Elijah, with Peter and James and John. On that day, those three bumblers found themselves reflecting the light of Christ, human and divine. Maybe that light is simply love. Maybe love is what they witnessed, and love is what they carried into the world. And maybe it's just as simple as that. We too can embody love. We too can embody God. May it be so.